This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Iran repeats its stance on the removal of U.S. sanctions following its talks with the remaining JCPOA signatories.
They should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a fresh retaliatory drone strike on a major airbase in Saudi Arabia. Also ahead, Brazil experiences its deadliest day of the coronavirus pandemic by reporting nearly 4,200 new deaths. Welcome. Iran's deputy foreign minister says Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the 2015 nuclear agreement and is demanding the full removal of all U.S. sanctions before returning to full compliance. This came after a meeting of the Joint Commission of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in Vienna. Homa Leski reports.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining participants of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. The sides have set up two expert-level working groups that are going to come up with two lists, one of sanctions to be lifted by the United States and the other of nuclear measures to be undertaken by Iran in order for the country to return to full compliance with the nuclear agreement. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the deal and is demanding the full removal of sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance.
Iran says it has not and will not engage in any direct or indirect talks with the U.S., and it would be up to the other JCPOA signatories, namely Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, to talk to the Americans. The Joint Commission will meet again in Vienna on Friday to review the work of the expert groups and discuss sequence and timing. But if there's a lack of progress, Tehran says, it will end the talks. We are not in a hurry, says Iran's lead delegate. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Iran's top negotiator says the first round of talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal was constructive and on the right track.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance. So we have to make it clear that this is our position, but we are quite serious. If we wanted to avoid full compliance to the JCPOA. We would have done it before. We would have totally withdrawn from the JCPOA once the U.S. administration, the previous U.S. administration left the JCPOA. So we are quite serious. Nobody can question Iran's goodwill. The JCPOA is alive because of Iran, and we have paid a heavy price for that. Our people have suffered from the sanctions imposed by the United States. And now, if they want to revive JCPOA, if they want to come back to the JCPOA, they should lift all sanctions at once. I think it was constructive and in the right track. It's too soon to say that it has been successful. That would be known after the work of the working groups. But, of course, we are hopeful. If we were not hopeful, we would have not been here. We would move based on our own policies, on our own instructions, and if the other side can, meet our demands, of course, then we can say that it's a successful negotiation.
The European Union describes as constructive Tuesday's talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. European Union Chief Negotiator Coordinator Enrique Mora said the bloc will increase separate contacts with the JCPOA partners as well as with the U.S. The U.S. State Department also welcomed the talks in Vienna, saying the negotiations were constructive. Robert Molly, the envoy heading the U.S. delegation, said Washington's maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. Earlier, a spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry said Washington should return to the nuclear pact unconditionally and lift all, quote, illegal sanctions against Tehran. Zhao Lijian described the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA as the reason for the deal falling into disarray. Political commentator David Yagubian says the former U.S. administration intentionally made it difficult for the next president to return to the Iran nuclear deal by imposing many sanctions on Tehran.
I think that it's positive that Abbas Araghchi characterized the Vienna talks, at least the two working groups that have been created in the process so far, as being constructive and on the right track. But with that said, I don't believe that the real negotiations, the important ones regarding the full U.S. return to compliance within the JCPOA and the ability to verify it is being waged in Vienna. It's going on in Washington, D.C., where it seems now the Biden administration is interested in returning to the agreement, but it faces the so-called wall of sanctions that were purposefully set up in bad faith by the Trump administration, especially in its last few waning months, to prohibit the easy return of the Biden administration to the JCPOA. And much of this was accomplished by either relabeling or renaming certain previous sanctions, such as those that you mentioned that were maintained under the Barack Obama administration, to recast them as being related to terrorism. Of course, this is complete malarkey, but this was set up on purpose to prohibit a swift return through, say, executive orders to the JCPOA. And so, again, it's important that some progress has been made in terms of bringing the United States to this point.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a fresh retaliatory drone strike on Saudi Arabia's southwestern Asir region or province. A spokesman for the Yemeni armed forces said they hit sensitive targets in King Khalid Air Base in the Saudi city of Khamis Mushayt using two drones. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition claims to have intercepted an explosive-laden drone launched by Ansarullah. Yemenis have stepped up their attacks on Saudi Arabia in recent months. They say the retaliatory strikes will continue as long as Riyadh carries on with its airstrikes and blockade. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen 6 years ago. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives as a result. Yemenis have rallied outside the UN office in the capital Sana'a to denounce the international community's silence on Saudi's blockade on their country. The protesters also slammed the U.S. as an accomplice in the Saudi-led coalition's crimes against the people of Yemen. Our correspondent in the capital, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's US-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Brazil has registered nearly 4,200 new coronavirus deaths, another single-day record since the disease first appeared in that South American nation. Brazilian officials also reported almost 87,000 cases of the virus in 24 hours. Latest figures have pushed the country's overall death toll to nearly 337,000 out of over 13 million cases so far. Brazil is the second worst-hit nation in the world after the U.S. in terms of both fatalities and infections from COVID-19. Meanwhile, experts in the U.S. have warned of cases surging once again as a more contagious coronavirus variant has spread to all 50 states. American health officials have so far reported more than 30.8 million confirmed cases and over 556,000 deaths from the virus. Political commentator David Barkin says the situation in Brazil is extraordinary and involves a tremendous renunciation of responsibilities by the government.
The situation in Brazil is extraordinary. It really involves a tremendous renunciation of responsibility by the government, by the leadership, and an extraordinary lack of respect for the people and the environment. So the situation there is extraordinarily serious, and it's being accompanied by violence in all of the major cities. If we look at other countries in Latin America, Chile has made substantial advances in terms of vaccination. The third wave of the coronavirus outbreak is also threatening to raise those statistics. They don't come up on the international map as much because Chile is a small country with less than 30 million people in it. And you have, in many other countries now in Latin America, you have a tremendous fear of the increase of the new wave of the virus, which threatens government stability and the health and the economy of countries throughout the region.
Day 7 of the trial of white former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin for murdering African-American George Floyd has concluded. A Minneapolis police lieutenant testifies that a move used by Chauvin was not an authorized neck restraint.
A knee on the neck would be something that does happen in use of force that isn't unauthorized.
And so if there was, say for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
You could take
Johnny Mercel, who teaches the proper use of force for the city's police department, gave the statement after he was shown a photograph of Chauvin using his knee to pin Floyd's neck to the ground. Mercel also stated that the officers attempting to restrain Floyd were not able to touch and examine the carotid artery, considering Chauvin's knee placement. Meanwhile, Officer Nicole McKenzie, who leads the Minneapolis Police Department's emergency medical response training, told jurors that the police are trained to check the pulse and perform CPR when necessary.
if they are unable to find a pulse?
If you don't have a pulse on a person, you'll immediately start CPR. There is a possibility that somebody could be in respiratory distress and still being able to verbalize it. Just because they're speaking doesn't mean they're breathing adequately.
The testimonies came a day after the Minneapolis police chief said the neck restraint used by Chauvin on the deadly arrest violated the department's policy. Police chief said Chauvin broke rules and ethics code and also noted that his actions were not part of police training. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. His defense team has argued that Chauvin did only what he was trained to do in his 19 years as a police officer. 46-year-old Mr. Floyd's death sparked massive protests against police brutality in the U.S. Well, let's get you more on that story through the help of my good friend, Dr. Colin Campbell, who joins us via Skype out of Washington, D.C. Colin, what more can you tell us about the recent developments that have taken place?
Yeah, well, this is a really damaging part to the defense because of the testimony that although the accused, the defense, has a history of being a police officer, the technique that he used, according to experts, people who are familiar with his field, are saying that he did use improper technique. And of course, this really attacks the defense for the type of characterization they're trying to play up Derek Chauvin as, an experienced police officer, someone who was afraid of George Floyd because he might have had something in his system, somebody who was resisting constantly. This kind of flew in the face of all of that, and saying that once a person is in prone position on the ground, face down on the ground, and in handcuffs, and is not moving, that person is really no longer a threat to the police. Never mind to have someone's neck or the breathing of that person to be somewhat restricted or totally obstructed for nearly 10 minutes. And so we're looking at this case and we're seeing that the defense has a difficult case to prove here, even though it will only take one juror to be in doubt, which some people are very skeptical about. The defense still has a very difficult case to point out here because of all of the people that are coming in saying that the police officer used excessive force, had his knee on the neck for too long, did not use proper procedure, that something could have been done that could have kept George Floyd alive but kept him incarcerated or detained. There are all of these different types of testimonies that are coming out supporting this type of evidence. But the defense, of course, is going to be working very hard to show that maybe Mr. Floyd was out of control, which is what led to police officer Chauvin to use this type of excessive force.
My good friend, Dr. Colin Campbell, thank you. Take care. The United Nations has warned of a record level of starvation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with about one-third of the population suffering from acute hunger. The UN says a record 27.3 million Congolese are in dire need of food, largely because of conflicts in the country and the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. The World Food Program and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization say the figure makes Congo home to the most people needing urgent food assistance. Congo has been the scene of conflict for decades now, particularly in the eastern borderlands with Burundi, Rwanda, and Uganda, despite the official end to a civil war in 2003. Well, that's it for me.
We are with you.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
As a reminder, dear listeners, we said in our last program that the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, highly respected the source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Hossein Boujardi, and never allowed anyone to disrespect him, as he was the head of the seminaries in the 1950s. Today we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's stance towards Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Hakim, who was a great source of emulation in Iraq. Please stay with us. Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Hakim was one of the great sources of emulation some 60 years ago. He was born in a family of ulama and religious scholars, and his father, Sayyid Mahdi Hakim, was one of the great jurisprudents in Najaf. After the demise of Grand Ayatollah Naini, some of his emulators referred to Grand Ayatollah Hakim. Later on, after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani, Grand Ayatollah Hakim became famous as one of the leading jurisprudents and a source of emulation. Then, after the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Boujardi, Grand Ayatollah Hakim became more famous. In addition to writing several books, he made great effort to organize seminaries and played a major role in prevention of infiltration of communism in Iraq. After the coup d'etat of Abdul Karim Qasim in Iraq and his coming to power in 1958, the ground was prepared for propagation of communism and the passage of laws incompatible with Islamic tenets and principles. Under such circumstances, Grand Ayatollah Hakim officially protested against the measure and urged religious scholars or ulama and preachers to make people aware of the anti-religious nature of these new legislations. Moreover, he issued two fatwas or religious edicts, which prohibited joining the Communist Party. These religious edicts or fatwas caused other ulama in the city of Najaf to issue similar fatwas, forcing the tyrant Abdul Karim Qasim to retreat and apologize. Grand Ayatollah Hakim carried out good political activities to defend the Iraqi and the Iranian peoples, but he had differences with Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, in the way of political struggles against the ruling system in the two countries. He protested against jailing and torturing of opponents by the government of Abdusalam Aref and the sectarian and discriminatory policies at the time by the Iraqi Ba'athist regime. He even issued a fatwa during the repression of the Kurds in Iraq by RF, which called it illegitimate to enter war against the Kurds. The religious edict or fatwa prevented the killing of Iraqi Kurds. Grand Ayatollah Hakim even called on all Muslims to stand firm against the occupation of Palestine by the Zionist regime of Israel. Furthermore, in the incident of the burning of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque in the city of Al-Quds in 1969, he issued a statement to remind Muslims of their religious and historical responsibilities and duties against the Zionists. As for some of the developments in Iran, such as the bloodshed at the Fazir school in Qom and the massacring of thousands of innocent people on 5th of June 1963 by the bloodthirsty Pahlavi regime, Grand Ayatollah Hakim expressed his opposition. Yet his approach was different from that of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. He didn't agree with nationwide uprising against the regimes in Iran and Iraq, and he was concerned about repetition of the bloody repression of the Iraqi people in the 1920s. Since his arrival in the city of Najaf, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, tried to inform Grand Ayatollah Hakim of Iran's political developments, especially the oppressive and unjust rule of the Pahlavi regime. One of the current sources of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Nuri Hamedani, narrates an account on this issue. Grand Ayatollah Nuri Hamedani says, on the advent of Imam Khomeini's arrival in Najaf, one night he paid a visit to Grand Ayatollah Hakim. Many students accompanied the Imam. The Imam proposed to Grand Ayatollah Hakim to take a trip to Iran to see Iran's conditions closely and not to be content with reports from Iran. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, always urged Grand Ayatollah Hakim to be a leader in the struggles against the despotic regimes in both Iran and Iraq. Hujjatul Islam Murtaza Sadeghi Tehrani says in this regard, although Imam Khomeini was a prominent scholar amongst religious scholars and ulama and used to behave humbly before late Grand Ayatollah Hakim to inform him of developments in Iran, he would say to Grand Ayatollah Hakim, I am one of your followers and among those who obey your commands. If you order, we will obey. If you command, we will act. How do you think that you have no one to obey you whilst I am one of them? As it was said earlier, there were differences between Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and Grand Ayatollah Hakim, particularly with regards to the killing of ulama and students at the Fazir school in Qom. After the savage assault by the Pahlavi regime's military against the Fazir school, Grand Ayatollah Hakim asked the Iranian religious scholars to migrate to Iraq. But the revolutionary ulama, especially Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, opposed this proposal. Nevertheless, the Imam never allowed anyone to disrespect Grand Ayatollah Hakim. It is narrated that once an Iranian student in the city of Najaf said something against Grand Ayatollah Hakim. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, immediately protested against the move and reprimanded the student.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. I'm Hassanain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawdha Ilmiya Qum. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Brother Mudha, one of our listeners has written to us that a few months ago my brother and his family went to Ziyarah in the Middle East, Iran and Iraq. And when they came back, their children, who are the same age as my children, had different things that were from an Islamic culture, like rings, dishdoshe, different types of tasbih, and etc. My children obviously weren't the same. On one aspect, I understand the importance. However, living in the West, it's very much against the local culture. So I'm a bit worried about this. What do you suggest me to do? So of course, Brother Mullah, it's living in an Islamic country, the best thing is that you can follow your Islamic culture. But what do you suggest that brother was living in the West and faced these kind of problems?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There's a lot we can talk about in relation to this topic of culture, local culture, uh-huh. Islamic culture, and those things that represent culture, such as rings and clothes and different artifacts that are related to culture. I'm not going to go into too much details, obviously. This is mainly to answer the question, but to mention a couple of points. Firstly, we have to understand that culture is very important,
mm-hmm.
right? And the reason why culture is very important is because culture is a reflection of a ideology, value, and principle of a society.
Mm-hmm. True, that's right.
And therefore, once somebody has an Islamic ideology, an mm-hmm. Islamic notion and understanding, and Islamic values and principles that they mm-hmm. want to abide by, naturally they will have a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want to be very frank, today's Western culture yeah. is very much against an Islamic culture.
Yeah,
scared of saying that, and the reason simply why, if somebody asks why are you saying that Islamic culture is against the Western culture, for mm-hmm. example, the reason is very much exactly why I just mentioned that, is because a culture is a representation of an ideology, value, and principle, mm-hmm. and you realize that the Western ideology and the Western values and principles are very much, in many aspects, not True. Just few but many aspects, in complete contradiction to an Islamic ideology, values, and principles. To name a few is just religion, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Western ideology is based on secularism. It's based on the notion that you don't have religion in society.
Yeah.
It's based on the fact that knowledge is separated from religion. It's based on an understanding that morality is mm. different from religion, that you yeah. can be moral without religion.
Yeah.
These are ideologies that Islam doesn't agree with. Yeah. Islam talks about religion as the principal fundamental source of knowledge,
True.
Source of morality, etc. Now, obviously, the whole discussion is something that we can that requires another platform. But the reason why I mentioned is that we have to understand that we live in a world where there's different types of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
and these cultures are a reflection of ideology. And what we want is to be able to abide by a culture that is Islamic. Now, having said that, you have to understand that cultures overlap as well. Uh-huh. Right? It's not that you have distinct cultures that have no overlap.
Yeah.
In other words, if I want to say it this way, it's very possible for you to, I will make it very cliche, mm-hmm. it's very possible for you to eat French fries and burger and be a Muslim, right? Or to wear jeans and t-shirt, for example, and play football and watch the Premier League, for example, and be a good Muslim. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah.
So the point I want to get across is those aspects of religion or those aspects of cultures that have an impact on religion, these are the ones that we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And these are the ones that play an important role in what we want to, how we want to address this question.
Yeah, thank you so much. Brother Mbal, let's take a short break over here, and your audience, do not go anywhere. We'll be right back after the break.
Wait, stop! I got a
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break we were talking about different cultures, Islamic culture and Western culture, and we were talking about their aspects of the different cultures. So Brother Mbal, please continue.
The first point I'd like to mention regarding this interlap and this relationship between Islamic culture and other cultures is that Islam as such doesn't have a culture that would be complete as such. Like, I won't say that Islam has very specific things that you have to eat, very specific clothes that you have to wear, very specific language that you talk. None of these are part of an Islamic culture, right? In that sense, Islam is very, the religion comes rather to help the cultures to achieve their potential.
So Islam has given us the standards.
Islam gives us principles, right?
Yeah.
So for example, Islam, just like a culture will say, for example, I don't know, the Italian culture, for example, based on a typical type of food, a typical type of way of speaking, a language, a dress code, etc. Islam will come and make these, adapt these to fit a general principle that goes back to the goal of the human being and the fitrah of the human being, and to make this human being reach its perfection, which is the servitude of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So for example, Islam won't come and say that you have to eat, I don't know, this particular type of food. But it will come and say that your food has to be halal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It will come and say, for example, that your food has to be slaughtered, your meat has to be slaughtered in a particular way. It will come and tell you, for example, don't eat too much, just as you don't want to eat too less.
Yeah.
Okay. It will come and say, for example, before you start eating, say Bismillah. So the etiquettes of eating, the what to eat, how to eat, when to eat, it will give you guidelines, basically.
But this, like, in every aspect of life.
Exactly. Every aspect of life. And these guidelines can be adopted in any culture, whether you can be Iranian, whether you can be Iraqi, whether you can be British, whether you can be Italian or Brazilian. It doesn't make a difference. As long as you adapt these principles and these guidelines in your culture, your culture can be directed towards what you want to achieve as a human being, which is your path and your goal and your journey towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So in the example, coming to the question example that you mentioned, for example, the dishdasha, right? The dishdasha, for those who don't know, is the long piece of cloth that Arabs wear, usually. Usually white, you see Saudi Arabians and Iraqis, they wear these big long piece of cloth, quite elegant usually. It looks quite nice. Now, you can say from one aspect is it's part of a Middle East culture, right? I wouldn't say it's an Islamic culture, right? In the sense that you wouldn't say that if somebody who doesn't wear this dasha is not a Muslim or is far from achieving his potential and won't achieve the goal of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if they don't wear this dasha.
That's not the case.
We don't have anywhere in Islam that you have to wear this dasha.
So is there any dress that we can call it as Islamic dress?
So the Islamic dress will be a dress that covers your body in a way that brings about modesty. That brings about an appearance that is a good, presentable appearance. So any cloth. So you take a trousers and a shirt, for example. You take a suit. You take a Punjabi dress, for example. Right? You take a Brazilian hat, for example. I don't know. You take all these different types of clothing. As long as they fit in the set, they're presentable, they look nice, decent, they present the human value and dignity of the human being, they cover your body in a humble way, okay? These are guidelines. So if you come out, for example, wearing a man who comes out and wears women clothes, for example, or wear clothes that are so dirty that it actually doesn't, you don't feel like talking to this person. These are against Islamic, you would say, guidelines, basically, that. But no, they're clothes from different types of culture, but they fit in the principle of the Islamic guidelines, then it's fine. They don't have to be at this dasha as such.
Thank you so much, Brother Muntad. Let's take a short break over here.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, "Raise your children to have free features. Love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break we were discussing about the different dressing forms and how we can have different dressing forms with respect to the Islamic principles.
The other example that we used in the example in the question, sorry, is rings, right? So, again, for those who are not aware, we have in Islamic culture or in Islamic guidelines, we have these special rings that are recommended for men and also women to wear as well. Which is, for example, the Aqiq stone or the Firoda stone. There are different types of stones that we have in our traditions, and the Ahlul Bayt have taught us that these are good things to wear. Now, this is where you have, this particular example comes more in the aspect of guidelines, basically, where this is not related to any culture, okay? Rather, Islam says that whatever culture you are, whether you can be a British culture, American culture, South African culture, a Chinese or Indonesian culture, this goes back to a guideline that's applicable to any culture, that in every culture that you are, this kind of, you would call it jewelry for men, or these kind of rings, basically, and these kind of stones, they're recommended for every, because they go back to helping you on your journey. Obviously, it's not obligatory, but they go and help you in your journey towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is not related to any culture. This is not something to do specifically with Arabs, for example, or specifically to do with Persian. This is something to do with, goes back to what Islam teaches us. So this is something definitely that we would try and encourage our children, try and incorporate in our lives as well. If we are able to, then definitely wear the ring. It doesn't go back to being from the Middle East. It goes back to being part of an Islamic culture, basically. So wherever you live, I would definitely recommend that this is worth thinking. And it doesn't go against any other culture as well. It's not something that if you wear, for example, in the West, it'll be seen as bad. No, on the contrary, it's seen as, I mean, in the West, we have different types of ring, different types of rings that are in fashion. Muslims can wear the blue ring, for example, which is the Firoza, or the red ring, for example, the yellow one, whichever stone you like that are recommended in our tradition. So to conclude, I know we're coming to the end of the show. I wanted to put across this point that we have to be able to analyze which is the culture part and how Islam plays a role in bringing these principles to different types of cultures, and those things that are part of those principles. Which one of them was the ring, for example.
So thank you so much, Brother Muntad, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, farstoday.com. Fi amanullah. Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo told the Derek Chauvin murder trial on Monday, 5th of April, that he vehemently disagreed that there was any justification for the former police officer to keep his knee on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. The Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo said on the sixth day of the trial that Derek Chauvin's treatment of the 46-year-old black man breached regulations and showed a disregard for sanctity of life. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, "Chauvin's Use of Force on George Floyd Was in No Way Policy," says police chief. Stay with us for more of Chris McGreal's article. The Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo told the Derek Chauvin murder trial on Monday, 5th of April, that he vehemently disagreed that there was any justification for the former police officer to keep his knee on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. The Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo said on the sixth day of the trial that Derek Chauvin's treatment of the 46-year-old black man George Floyd breached regulations and showed a total disregard for sanctity of life. Once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that should have stopped, he said. The police chief said that whilst it might have been reasonable to use a certain level of force to get him under control in the first few seconds, Derek Chauvin's subsequent actions did not meet the standard of objectively reasonable force. To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, he said. Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo said that, far from being aggressive, George Floyd appeared to be completely passive. As a matter of fact, as I saw that video, I didn't even know if Mr. Floyd was alive at that time, he said. It is highly unusual for a police chief to give evidence against one of his own police officers. Arredondo, Minneapolis's first black police chief, fired Derek Chauvin shortly after George Floyd's death. Derek Chauvin, a 45-year-old, has denied charges of second and third degree murder and manslaughter. He faces up to 40 years imprisonment if convicted of the most serious charge. Three other police officers face charges. George Floyd's death last year reinvigorated the Black Lives Matter movement and prompted mass protests for racial justice across the United States as well as in other parts of the world. The prosecutors spent the day on Monday, 5th of April, building a case that Derek Chauvin failed to follow his training to consider whether George Floyd's resisting arrest was a deliberate attempt to resist or an inability to comply because of issues such as medical conditions, mental impairment, or the influence of drugs. On Thursday, George Floyd's girlfriend testified that he was addicted to opioids, and another witness said that he appeared to be high shortly before his arrest. Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo agreed that a person under the influence of drugs might be more vulnerable than dangerous. The police chief said that Chauvin should have considered a number of factors in how he dealt with Floyd. Is the person a threat to the police officer and others? What is the severity of the crime? Are you re-evaluating and assessing the individual's medical condition? Said Arredondo. Considering all those issues, the police chief Arredondo added, I vehemently disagree that that was an appropriate use of force. The Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo also said that Derek Chauvin also appeared not to have been following his training to de-escalate a confrontation. You want to always have de-escalation layered into those actions of using force, said Arredondo. Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, put it to Arredondo that the use of force, such as an officer pointing a gun, could be a de-escalation tactic under certain circumstances if it prevents greater violence. The police chief Arredondo was hesitant, but said it could sometimes be the case. The police chief questioned the need to detain George Floyd at all, saying that it would not be normal to arrest a person for passing a counterfeit bill because it's not a violent felony. The prosecutor also drew Arredondo's attention to the failure of former police officer Derek Chauvin and other police officers with him to render medical assistance to George Floyd when he stopped breathing. The police chief said that all officers are trained in first aid and absolutely have a duty to render it to a person having a medical crisis, such as George Floyd, when he said he could not breathe and then passed out. Earlier on Monday, 5th of April, the emergency room doctor who tried to save George Floyd's life told the trial he most likely died of asphyxiation. Dr. Bradford Langenfeld said he saw no evidence George Floyd was killed by a heart attack or a drug overdose, as Derek Chauvin's defense has claimed in attempting to deny that the death resulted from the police officer keeping his knee on the detained man's neck for more than 9 minutes. Dr. Bradford Langenfeld, who declared George Floyd dead, told the court there was not a heartbeat sufficient to sustain life, and that he believed cardiac arrest was brought on by lack of oxygen. He was asked by the prosecutor if there was another term for that. Asphyxia, said Langenfeld. The doctor said he thought a heart attack was unlikely because when he cut open George Floyd's chest, he saw no evidence of that. He also said the paramedics who brought him to the hospital said George Floyd showed no behavior typical of the condition. There was no report that the patient complained of chest pain or was clutching his chest, he said. The state medical examiner found that George Floyd's death was caused by cardiopulmonary arrest, which the prosecution says is a broad enough term that can be applied to any death because it means only that a person's heart and lungs have stopped functioning. The defense claims the finding means George Floyd died of a heart attack. However, Langenfeld told the court a delay in treating George Floyd, particularly giving him CPR, may have reduced his chances of survival. Ambulance paramedics reported that the police made no effort to give George Floyd medical assistance, even though he had passed out and was unresponsive by the time they arrived on the scene. The trial continues. Meanwhile, the Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said residents of Minneapolis remain on edge about the outcome of the trial. On Sunday, 4th of April, on CNN's State of the Union program, Ilhan Omar was reminded that few trials involving police officers result in a conviction. She was asked, "Are you and your city prepared for the possibility of a hung jury or not a guilty verdict?" Ilhan Omar replied, "The community is on edge about that. We have seen justice not delivered in our community for many years. I think that there is a lot of confidence in State Attorney General Keith Ellison and the prosecutors in this case, but we are all eagerly awaiting to see how this trial shakes out." Congresswoman Ilhan Omar added, "It's been really horrendous to watch the defense put George Floyd on trial instead of the former police officer who's charged with his murder." George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died last May when former police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest. The killing sparked international protests against police brutality and racial injustice in the United States.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.